Mr. Secretary, it's a great pleasure and a privilege to have you. You've had such a long and deep experience at several positions leading the United States of America. And now, in this interview, I would like to start briefly with the 12-day war against Iran. According to U.S. President Trump, the U.S. and Israel have obliterated the Iranian nuclear capabilities. How has the architecture of powers in the Middle East and beyond changed through this combined Israeli and U.S. military mission?
First, it's great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity. If you broadly understand what has changed since October 7th of 2023, I think obliterate is a fair characterization. It's fundamentally reshaped the Middle East, not just the strikes on the facilities at Isfahan or the facilities at Fordow or Natanz, but more broadly speaking, the takedown of Hezbollah and of Hamas, the fact that Assad has had to flee, now gives the Gulf Arab states and Israel an opportunity to fundamentally rethink what these relationships look like over the next decades. And as far as the nuclear program goes, I have no doubt that it was a setback. But having said that, so long as the Ayatollah's in power, they're going to continue to march down that path because they view it as central to their security. They view building out a weapons program as something that protects them. And so so long as the regime is still in power, I suspect that no matter what the actual physical damage to these centrifuges was, to the electrical grid, to the power systems, to the tools around it, I suspect that the process of rebuilding has already begun. It will be hard for them to do because their leadership has been decimated, but we should all be thankful for what the Israelis and President Trump did, because I think it makes not only the region safer, but Europe and the United States as well, because we all know the world's largest state sponsor for terror for, goodness gracious, for decades has emanated from Tehran. And now that capacity for Iran to partner with Russia, to partner with China, and to conduct terror is greatly diminished.
Now, President Trump has reestablished the U.S. role as a world leader in only a few months since he's been back in office. Key to this is his doctrine, so-called doctrine. Some describe it as, quote, strategic uncertainty. How would you describe Trump's doctrine, and has it changed compared to the first term where you were in charge as Secretary of State?
You know, I think there are things that are different about the second Trump administration, but this piece is actually entirely the same. He has been a realist in the sense of he understands power, the effective use of power. He understands that sending large troop forces to the Middle East and other places is no longer the solution to actually delivering a deterrence model. And so in the first term, it was, moving the embassy, right? Making clear that the things that had been the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, that these things that had been red lines, the things that with, the response was always, well, we'd love to do that, but it will cause World War III. President Trump has been pretty consistent saying, well, those were accepted theories. We're going to go test them. We're going to go do our work, our intelligence work, and strategically go take these, go confront these things that present long-term risk to the United States and to Europe and to the world. And so the strike on Soleimani was another example where previous presidents had just said, no, we can't touch that. President Trump's deterrence model, right, much like Reagan's was, You can't negotiate absent a willingness and a perceived willingness to use American power. And I think he has shown that. That's how he's gotten America back on its front foot. And I think this is much to the good for the entire world. We still have war raging in Europe. This needs to be brought to a conclusion as well. But what's taken place in the Middle East, I think, begins to shape the great threat of our time, the Chinese Communist Party, and how it thinks about America and its place in the world as well.
You know, the war against Iran was essentially an amazing mission by Israeli intelligence. I mean, that's how it's all started. The Mossad had secretly built a drone hub inside Iran. You know, they infiltrated the top level of the Mullah regime. They simultaneously eliminated key operators in the Revolutionary Guard and the government. And before, we witnessed a stunning, sophisticated attack on the leadership of Hezbollah with pages, etc. Now, in the face of this brilliance, military brilliance, one cannot stop wondering if no one and why no one in the Israeli intelligence and military leadership had been able to avert the attacks of October 7th, which were in the making
for a
long time. So those exceptionally brutal attacks had been planned for months, if not years. My question is, how could the best intelligence have missed this attack?
Yeah, it's, you know, having served as America's senior intelligence official, I can tell you, but it's both difficult to understand how it can happen and completely understandable. And it both can be true. Really good data, really good analytics, and yet the perception had become that they had a détente, they had an understanding with Hamas. Hamas won't do this because we allow 60,000 folks come work in Israel and we've allowed them, you know, enough food. We've given them control. Why would they upset that? Because if they upset that, we will destroy them. And they know that. And therefore, this noise that they had seen, this is my guess, the noise that they had seen about, you know, kites flying and tunnels, they saw all that noise and they for years believed, yeah, sure, they're doing that, but it's just... They will never do what they did on October 7th because it will lead to their destruction, and they know that. And yet they proved wrong. In the end, Hamas took the bet, said, yep, we know this risks everything. I think the Iranian leadership told them this is go time too. I think others in the region could see that normalization was beginning to expand and Iran's foothold was beginning to slip already. And they thought maybe we can go do this on October 7th and... the Americans and the Israelis will shrink away from this fight. It turned out they made a bad bet, a bad tactical bet, and a bad strategic bet as well.
Now, President Trump was very enthusiastic about finishing the war in Ukraine and fast. I mean, he mentioned 24 hours, but nevertheless, you know, everybody was realistic and expected or almost, you know, hoped for a fast ending. Now, those efforts seem to have been in vain. Now, Trump seems to have lost patience with President Putin. He recently said, quote, we get a lot of BS bullshit thrown at us by Putin. He's very nice all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless. Now, and on Sunday, I mean, just 2 days ago, one day ago, he said that the U.S. is now sending to Ukraine badly needed Patriot air defense missile to help, you know, fend off the Russia's intensifying aerial attacks. You have dealt with Vladimir Putin for years as head of the CIA and Secretary of State. Flat out, can the West trust Putin at all? After all this charade, and it's, we have to call it that way, can he be trusted? And how should America and the West deal with the Russian president?
No, Putin is not to be trusted one iota, not one bit, not one moment. His intentions are abundantly clear. He's pretty transparent about them. He would like to restore something that was akin to the Russian Empire, right? He can't. He's now demonstrated that it's not possible for his military to achieve that. But whatever it is he says or promises should be taken as useless. This is about real power. And I think President Trump knows this. I think he was hopeful that Putin would recognize that he was a different character. He was very different than President Biden, and that he would ultimately come to a place to impose real costs on him. But Putin, and therefore you could get a deal that was backed up by real security architecture around it, not a deal on paper that's useful, but then a real security architecture that wraps around that to prevent Putin from furthering his advance. And I think President Trump gave him a lot of space to go try to do that. Zelensky got the message, right? President Zelensky understood Trump's going to end this thing. He's going to find a path to settle this. And we need to try to be part of that. Putin hasn't accepted that. I hope he doesn't I hope he doesn't think that President Trump will cave, because if he does, that means more death and destruction. Because I'm very confident that President Trump understands the need for the West to win, the West to prevail in this conflict, and importantly, for the perception to be that the West has won. If it is viewed as a naked aggression, an attack on Europe is rewarded in a material way, the challenges that the United States and we all will face in the Pacific from the Chinese will be magnified. And if the West pushes back, the West imposes real costs in this conflict, I think that will send a strong message to the leadership in China that the West is not in decay. It is not in decline. It's prepared to defend the things, its interests that matter to it. And we will have put the world in a much better place than we find ourselves today or did 3 or 4 years ago even.
You know, what is the definition of winning? What do you mean by the West has to win? Does it mean that all the oblasts, 4 oblasts in the east of Ukraine will be back to Ukraine, that the Russians will be pushed out, that the Crimea will be liberated in the sense of Ukrainians? What does winning mean?
So the trajectory of history would suggest that that's the ultimate goal. Crimea, each of the oblasts, Ukraine restored to where it was when the agreements were reached with the Budapest Memorandum in the early 1990s, right? That's where the boundaries were drawn. That's what everyone agreed to, including the Russians, had agreed to. In the near term, that seems implausible to me. That seems like a really difficult military and diplomatic goal. So what we should shoot for, that is, what does this mean? This means non-recognition. That is, the world should not acknowledge that Vladimir Putin has brought those into the Russian orbit. Politically, diplomatically, at the UN, all the places that sort of shape sovereignty, national sovereignty, should not recognize Vladimir Putin and Russia as in control. Second, a structure, a security architecture that is permanent, that says, whatever it is you may have, a tank or a missile or a drone today, or a soldier, that's as far as you go. And a security structure that prevents something like this, an outbreak like this, from ever happening again right away, whether that's in Ukraine or in Finland or right in the Baltics. Understand now that whether it's formally part of NATO or not is less material in my judgment. Whether it's formally part of NATO or not is less important in my judgment than the fact that there are European security assets put in place so as to convince the entirety of the world that this game's not going to be played again for another 25 years. We can say 50, maybe it's 10, but for an extended period of time. And then finally, a continued cost imposition on Vladimir Putin such that he was not materially, economically rewarded for what it is that he did. So long as the Chinese Communist Party continues to send North Korean soldiers to Russia to defend them, right? That's what you really have going on there. Those North Korean soldiers that are fighting in Russia today on Ukrainian territory, they went there at the direction of Xi Jinping. We have to make sure that this all gets pulled back and that defeat, which I know that the Russian military leadership must surely feel they've suffered already, 1 million casualties, that defeat is broadcast to the world so that tyrants and authoritarians that are revanchist powers no longer feel like they can roam about the cabin freely. That's winning. That's what this looks like.
Just briefly, there is the narrative that the US and Europe pushed Putin into this war by enlarging NATO eastwards, Ukraine being the ultimate red line for Russia. And, you know, Putin, of course, countless times he said that's like the red line. So therefore, they were allegedly forced to launch a special military operation to stop Western threats for Russia. I mean, that's a certain narrative that we hear. Did the West stretch NATO too fast and too far east, or does the West bear some responsibilities for the killing that is going on in Ukraine?
Yes, this is nonsense. Indeed, it's worse than that. It's nonsense that is Russian propaganda nonsense. The Ukrainian people chose to look west. This wasn't imposed by NATO. This was the Ukrainian people making a choice, saying, "No, we don't want to be part of these knuckleheads in Moscow. We want to prosper. We want peace. We want freedom. We want to get to vote for our leaders, and then sometimes have leaders that we don't like win elections. This is what democracy is, what happens in democracy. They chose to look westward. And so this idea that somehow Vladimir Putin felt threatened by NATO, that has never, right, has never conducted an offensive operation to steal land from Russia, right? Never, never in history. So there's no evidence that its intention is that. That's the storyline. I get it why Mr. Putin tells that story. It probably helps him convince his people to sleep better at night. But Vladimir Putin knows better too. He knows that's nonsense. This was an aggressive offensive effort, not some idea of, oh my gosh, they got too close to my border. For those who haven't been following the footprint, there's already NATO nations on Russia's border. Right, one of the narratives he says is we can't have NATO on our border. And it's like, come on, man, pull a map out.
Before I have to let you go, just one more question. Days after taking office again in January, President Trump revoked security details for you and other former key figures of the first administrations. And you have been, you've been speaking openly about this. You have been subject to threats after the elimination of General Soleimani that you also mentioned in this interview. Let me ask you straight out, how dangerously are you living these days? And can you explain why President Trump would do that? I mean, you need that security deposit. I mean, you're under threat.
I can't explain it. The threat from the Iranians against a number of former American senior officials, including myself, continues. That's certainly true. I now have security that I provide for myself, that I pay for myself. So we feel like we have this in a pretty good place. But I regret that President Trump made that decision, certainly for me. But more broadly than that, it seems to me that, you know, President Biden continued my security. He saw the threat against me and against Ambassador Bolton and against Ambassador O'Brien, against General McKinsey. There are a handful of others. And it seems appropriate to me that for actions taken in government service, if there are threats from nation state actors that are real, if the intelligence suggests they are real, that we ought to make sure that those people are provided protection. I can't account for why President Trump did it. I hope he'll rethink it. And I hope every president will rethink this for whomever, whether they're Democrat or Republican or some other party. This isn't about politics. This is about doing what's right by a nation and protecting those who have come under threat as a result of actions they took as government officials. And so this is where we find ourselves today. We work, we provide our own security, and then we trust the good Lord.
Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for your time, and stay safe.
I will. Bless you. You all stay safe too. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you.